I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
On this special Thanksgiving edition of Parallax Views, American conservatives have often laid claim to the Founding Fathers and the historical traditions of America. It begs the question, is there a radical tradition in American history that contrasts this narrative? Our guest on this edition of the program, historian and sociologist Harvey J. Kay, the Ben and Joyce Rosenberg Professor of Democracy and Justice Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay, says there is, in his new collection of essays and interviews entitled, Take Hold of Our History, Make America Radical Again. Available now from Zero Books. In addition to Take Hold of Our History, Harvey is also the author of such books as The Fight for the Four Freedoms, What Made FDR and the Greatest Generation Truly Great, Thomas Paine and the Promise of America, and Thomas Paine, Firebrand of the Revolution. He's also, as a side note, frequently collaborated with the acclaimed broadcast journalist Bill Moyers, whose decade-spanning work, I might add, comes highly recommended by Parallax Views. Along with all this, Harvey is a warm, cheerful, and optimistic man, brimming with hope and a steadfast belief in we, the people. Now, before we dive into the conversation, I left what could be considered a bit of an embarrassing blooper in at the beginning of our chat, because I think it illustrates Harvey's good-natured warmth perfectly. So if you ever wanted to hear me make a ridiculous mistake during an episode of Parallax Views, well, here you go. And with that being said, let's dive right into the conversation with Harvey J. Kay, author of Take Hold of Our History, Make America Radical Again. Welcome to Parallax Views, Harvey J. Kay, author of Take Hold of Our History, Make America Radical Again, and the Ben and Joyce Rosenberg Professor of Democracy and Justice Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Greenberg.
Green Bay.
University of Wisconsin-Green Bay.
Although this is, Wisconsin is a German-American state, so maybe there is a Greenberg somewhere in the state. Who knows?
Well, I want to talk about your new book out now from Zero Books, a friend of the podcast, Take Hold of Our History. But First, before we get into the need to make America radical again, maybe you could give some background for my listeners on how you became interested in topics like politics and the fight for social justice.
Well, I often tell the story about the fact that I grew up in the New York City area. My grandparents, three of the four of my grandparents had been immigrants to the United States as kids. One was born here in the United States, and my parents were a Greatest Generation couple. My father fought in World War II, served in the tanks in the Battle of the Bulge, was wounded, received a Purple Heart, and came back, like most veterans, committed to remaking his own life and remaking America at the same time. But the reason I mention all that is that my grandfather on my father's side would often come out, well, my grandparents were friends, they would come out to the suburban community where my father and mother had bought a house in the early 50s, mid-50s. And my grandfather, who was a trial lawyer in New York, would often read to me from Old Testament Bible stories and weave that kind of biblical past into the past that he knew growing up on the Lower East Side of New York City, which was, of course, where generations of Jewish immigrants had settled and then set out from there. But the other thing was is that he had been a young socialist on the Lower East Side. So the way in which he told the Old Testament Bible stories was sort of framed or tinged with a kind of social justice emphasis. And in time, I obviously came to appreciate the difference between a historical past and a biblical past. But I think he had already sort of imbued me with a sense that there was a meaning in history, and that if we took history seriously, it didn't only deal with the past, it dealt very much with the times in which we live, and that we had a kind of moral and political and for those of us who are writers and professors, an intellectual obligation to address questions of inequality and injustice, of exploitation and oppression. And when I talk about those kind of things, and back in the recesses of my mind, I know it's all of my thoughts are being fed by that early sense of the story of Exodus and the story of descent and a story of rebellion, a whole series of biblical experiences that may or may not have ever happened, but clearly my grandfather wove together with being a young socialist on the Lower East Side. So I think that's where it probably began. But I also tell the story about on my mother's side of the family, my grandfather on my mother's side was very much connected to the Brooklyn Dodgers organization. Some of his closest friends were in the Dodger, either on the field or in the dugout as managers. And regularly in the summer, he would spend as much time as he could at Ebbets Field, the Dodger Stadium in Brooklyn. And whenever I was available to go with him, we would go to Ebbets Field and sit either usually on the third base or first base line in the stands. Although occasionally I actually did get to go into the dugout and actually sit in the dugout. Don't ask me how that was legal. I just know that I did it. So the thing is that the Dodgers left Brooklyn in 1957, and when they left, not only was my grandfather devastated, but a whole generation of Dodgers fans were devastated. And I'm absolutely convinced that in a way that experience led me to seriously question capitalism, even as a child. How could some corporation just rip out of the bosom of a community something that meant so much to them? So at some point back in the I can't remember if it was the 80s, but probably in the early 90s, I wrote a piece on that experience of the loss of the Dodgers for a baseball magazine. And I titled it, following Karl Marx's words, "All that is solid melts into air." And the baseball magazine, so liked the piece, they created a whole issue on baseball and capitalism. And they had a number of sort of liberal, political and journalistic figures write. And my piece was up front in a column titled "All That Is Not All That Is Solid." That was the title of the piece, "The View from Left Field." So you might say that both my grandfathers on my father's side and my mother's side had this kind of influence, one by way of biblical history the biblical past, and weaving it together with socialism on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, and the other one, who had been born in the United States, taught. In his own way, he sort of introduced me to this remarkable team, the Brooklyn Dodgers, and it was the loss of the Dodgers that probably led me to have serious doubts about the morality of capitalism.
You know, it's interesting. Just as a side note, I always find it fascinating how people sort of associate. If you're religious in any way, it seems like today people immediately can assume that you have to be on the right wing, or that you have to be hyper conservative. Which I think you can be socially conservative if you're religious, but there's a long history of religious people in our country who believed in things like social justice. I was brought up Catholic, and here in Pittsburgh, we actually have the Thomas Merton Center. And he was a great Catholic thinker who was also very much in favor of social justice. But I think people forget about that sometimes. It's almost like that history has been covered up in a way.
Yeah, probably. Well, first of all, probably because churches have long been the source of sermons preaching the status quo. For example, one of the things that really struck me about religion is almost around that subject is that my original studies were in Latin American studies. I worked on landlords, and I worked first of all on international relations in Latin America, and then for my first graduate degree at the University of London, and then I did my PhD in agrarian studies and the relations between landlords and peasants, the whole question of exploitation, oppression, and the struggles to overcome it. And one of the things is that when you study the history of Latin America, it's fairly clear the role of the Catholic Church in sanctifying the oppression and the exploitation that accompanied Spanish colonialism and later the kinds of oppressive social orders that characterized Latin America in the 19th century into the 20th. However, it was also the case that there was this real Catholic dissenting tradition in Latin America challenging the exploitation and oppression. And one of the things that was clearly noticeable, especially in the study of peasant movements, is how often the peasants themselves would take hold of the Virgin, La Virgen, and make the Virgen their icon, their if you like their moral champion. So there were, if we fail to appreciate the ways in which the meaning of life and the universal experience of that question, we on the left will be making a terrible mistake as we try to build a more just and moral and democratic social order in the future.
Well, I think this ties in too to the topic of your new book, Take Hold of Our History, because we were talking about, you know, there are, you know, within religious traditions, people that were very oriented towards social justice. And yet we don't hear about that often. We also don't really hear about America as having a radical tradition that often. Maybe you could speak a little bit to that, because it flies in the face of this sort of narrative that the sort of right wing in this country owns, you know, the image of the founding fathers, when in fact you would argue they don't.
Well, I would argue they have no right to lay claim to them. In fact, I was telling my students today, I think one of my students was asking me about how it is that the conservatives sought to lay claim to the founding fathers, where did that come from? So let me say that for much of the 19th century, the question of the founders was a question that was struggled over. It was a really contested kind of thing. So, for example, obviously the elites would up in Boston and elsewhere would regularly refer to the founding fathers as if we were supposed to defend and protect the political order that they established. In other words, the role of American citizens in every generation was not to enhance or extend and deepen American republicanism and democracy, but rather the job of citizens was to protect that which the founders created. So that is, our job was to sustain a tradition, an old order of things. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, when one looks closely at the social movements of the 19th century that fought for social justice and intellectual freedoms and political freedoms and economic freedoms for that matter, it's fairly clear that they laid equal claim. They had equal right to lay claim to the founders. So, for example, I'll just lay out a trajectory of such movements. The religious free thinkers, the abolitionists, the women's rights advocates, the labor unionists from the very beginning, agrarian populists, socialists as we're moving into the late 19th century, capital P progressives in the 20th century, again, socialists and communists and anarchists and others, they didn't turn their back on the American story, especially immigrants in those generations. they sought to lay claim to what it meant to be an American and to deny the hold of the powers that be, the hold of the powerful and the propertied and the prestigious and the pious, for that matter. And they found reason to believe in a, if you like, a radical America, not only because of the Declaration of Independence, or for that matter, the preamble and the Bill of Rights in the Constitution, but they laid hold of my childhood hero, and to this day, my foremost hero, Thomas Paine. I mean, Thomas Paine, in Common Sense in 1776, published in January of 76, he was the one who called not only for the for a struggle for independence to turn the American rebellion into a revolution, he called for a real revolution to create an unprecedented small d, small r, democratic republic. As he said, we have it in our power to begin the world over again. And he basically held up, I'd like to tell people, he held up a mirror to Americans and said, look at who you are, what you're doing, and what you're capable of, and you can establish a new order for the world in which working people, ordinary people, common people govern themselves. They don't need kings. They don't need aristocrats. They don't need property folks. They don't need religious, you know, priests to tell them how to live. That they can govern themselves. So, again, in every one of those generations, when I wrote this book that was published in 2005, Thomas Paine and the Promise of America, I had originally thought that Paine's memory had been suppressed, and I was going to tell the story of his life, his labors, and the suppression of his memory. And what I discovered, which even historians and biographers of my generation had failed to consider, is the degree to which every single one of America's progressive movements had laid claim to the revolution, to the memory of the likes of Washington and Jefferson, and most especially to the likes of Thomas Paine. In fact, it's not in my original book, but I discovered since that book was published that even Martin Luther King Jr., his favorite quote, apparently, according to Vincent Harding, the scholar and himself a minister, Vincent Harding said that Martin Luther King's favorite quote was, we have it in our power to begin the world over again. And that whenever he was in a funk, whenever he was truly depressed about the state of affairs of the civil rights movement, that he would remember that line and draw hope and sustenance, moral and intellectual and political, from those lines. So my argument has been for some time that we need to reclaim the American story. Now, I'm not saying we should ignore the horrors and the tragedies and indeed the generations of exploitation and oppression that people suffered. What I'm saying is that we on the left have too often turned away from the American story because it is so filled with those kinds of experiences. And we've left it to the conservatives, quite smartly, the political conservatives and political figures in the conservative movement, no one more successful doing so than Ronald Reagan. We've left it to them to redefine the past and to try to control public education, literally to try to control what's taught in the schools, which is not an unusual thing to have happened in the American Board of Education story, but literally to leave out how it was that we've ended slavery, empowered women, empowered labor, how it is that we've made America not greater, but in a fashion greater, but we've made America try to live up to our professed ideals of freedom, equality, and democracy. I mean, if it hadn't been for those struggles, we might have stayed British. We'd be having a British accent right now. Okay, we might have stayed a nation characterized not by slavery or by debt bondage. We might have remained a nation in which women, you know, didn't have the right to vote and had never secured equalities, in which working people, for as much as we've been under siege for 40 years now, the working people might not have ever been able to organize unions and depend on the government at various times to support their right to do so. So my point is that it's our task on the left. And I don't just mean scholars. I mean folks like you with podcasts, journalists, academics like myself, political figures who literally abandoned the past for too long. It's our job to take hold of American history, remind Americans of who they are, and in that fashion help to make America radical again. I mean, that's the fundamental of it. And there's another part which we can get to later. But, you know, it kills me every time I turn on, and I try to avoid doing so, but if I turn on one of the cable news shows, and I'm not talking Fox, that's not even, the word news doesn't even apply there at all. But you turn on CNN or MSNBC and you listen to these talking heads, they just have no sense of the American progressive and radical story. They're all a bunch of, you know, talking head liberals who don't even appreciate the degree to which there were fighting liberals once upon a time. So, you know, it's frustrating that we don't remind ourselves of these things. And yet, I'll also add that those generations of radical action have imbued us with a real sense of, if you like, a democratic imperative. We know that things are messed. We know that things are wrong. We know that the inequality which prevails is truly threatening and may well ultimately destroy American democratic life. And we need to speak to those yearnings that we ourselves and our fellow citizens have and by reminding them who they are.
So I think what I'm getting there, and I want to make sure this is the case, is you're not saying, oh, we shouldn't look at, you know, maybe the aspects that would be considered historically unsavory about the founding fathers, you know, like slavery.
Right.
Or that, you know, another thing I see a lot of people do is I sometimes get uncomfortable when we fetishize our leaders and we don't
Yes.
look at the sort of masses who also bring about revolutions and change.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. In fact, that's a good segue to the other point that I was hoping to make. Okay. So when I was writing these last many decades, well, years, especially of American history, these last 25 years or so, one of the things that struck me is that indeed there were leaders who we have good reason to admire. Okay. This is not, I'm not scorning every political leader. I think we had two phenomenal presidents in Abraham Lincoln and Franklin Roosevelt. But I also have come to see, and this goes back to my work in Latin American studies and the study of peasant struggles, is this. When you look closely at American history, there are three mortal crisis moments. One, of course, in the 1770s, would there even be a United States, or would we remain 13 colonies under British control? That's that moment. Would Americans rise to the occasion, as Thomas Paine said, and endeavor to make the world over again? Then there's, of course, the Civil War, in which the Union is literally torn apart over the question of not simply states' rights, but truly the question of slavery. And then third, and is, of course, the 1930s New Deal, sorry, the 1930s Great Depression, which was devastating to American economic life and social life. It was a terrible catastrophe, and it was devastating to American public life and democracy. And we might well have ended up with a dictatorship if, in fact, Americans hadn't tried all the more to remember who they were. And then, of course, the threat of fascism. I mean, there's nothing that predetermined that we and our allies would necessarily win World War II. I mean, Americans might well have decided ahead of time that they really didn't want to get involved in the war and ended up negotiating somehow with the fascists and ended up turning America into some kind of fascist order. But so here's the thing. But as you look close, you do see, as I was saying, these really fascinating great leaders. You got writers like Thomas Paine. You do have the likes of a Washington and a Jefferson for all of their sins in slavery. You've got the Civil War. Lincoln was an extraordinary political figure, a brilliant man who was in many ways self-educated. Then you've got in the 1930s into the 1940s, Franklin Roosevelt, a man coming from a very prominent and wealthy background, but who had developed certain sensibilities which enabled him to feel what his fellow Americans felt and literally to engage their imaginations in recreating American life. But here's the thing. It isn't that you had phenomenal leaders. Or, you know, there's this quote. I should pull it out. It's in my book. Or no, maybe not in this book, another book. Rexford Tugwell, who was in the FDR Brains Trust and later the cabinet, he said, you know, we Americans are lucky. We've had leaders when we needed them. So Washington, if it wasn't for Washington, we might not have become a nation. If it wasn't for Lincoln, we might not have sustained the nation. If it wasn't for Franklin Roosevelt, we might have ended up with a dictatorship. But here's the thing. It's a great quote, but it's fundamentally wrong in a critical way. Those three leaders, to become the leaders they became, required great citizens. So, and those citizens I'm referring to are working people in all their diversity, who in the 1770s had staged a rebellion even before they knew what they were going to be fighting for. And it was that rebellion that so impressed Thomas Paine that that's when he said, we have it in our ability to begin the world over again, to start the world over again. And it's that dynamic of this rising of artisans and farmers and indeed slaves and others that pushed what we call the founding generation, pushed the founding generation to actually in Congress declare for independence. If there had not been that propulsion from below, that struggle on the part of working people, there would have been no declaration. If there had not been Thomas Paine's common sense, there would have been no declaration. And Thomas Paine himself came from a British working class, English working class background.
I was just going to say, I find it interesting. We didn't learn much about Thomas Paine when I was going to school. And since then, though, since I've learned about him, he's become one of my favorites.
Right.
I feel like sometimes I wish we had a play called Paine instead of, Hamilton.
Funny you should say that. You know what? Believe me, Alexander Hamilton had very little confidence in democracy, and he actually probably despised most working people. And yet he gets this Broadway show, which supposedly is reviving interest in the revolution and the founding generation and blah, 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 blah. Well, Lin-Manuel Miranda is obviously a musical and literary genius. I mean, he created something that not only made a lot of money, it excited a lot of people, young and old. Here's the irony, as you and I both wish he had done Paine and not Hamilton. The New York Times Book Review, maybe 2 years ago, I could be losing track of time, asked Lin-Manuel Miranda, interviewed him, and in the interview they asked him, what book should every American read? And what do you think he said? Thomas Paine's Common Sense. And I thought, oh my God, why couldn't he have done that? But I'm told by people who are specialists on the Caribbean that since Lin-Manuel Miranda obviously came out of the Caribbean, his family, that they have a kind of, if you like, a kind of chauvinism about the Caribbean. And maybe it's that excited him to write about Alexander Hamilton, who also grew up in the Caribbean and then came to North America. In any case, it would be great if there was a musical. I will tell you that I've advised two major one-man productions of plays on Thomas Paine. One in Philadelphia with a theater company called the I just blanked on the name of it. Something Horse Players, and a really great production. And then out west, probably the even grander production. Man named Ian Ruskin, who was a British actor trained to the Royal Academy of Drama, he came to the United States and got very much involved in progressive politics and originally actually did a one-man show about Harry Bridges, the international longshoreman leader of the 30s and 40s. But he got really fascinated by Thomas Paine, and he wrote a play, which I advise and a number of other people, and he and I got particularly close, which if you ever get a chance, go online, and I think you can see a good part of the play at either PBS online or YouTube. It's really quite a remarkable production. I had him out here to do it for my students. He's done a lot of college performances around the country. But Paine's more alive now than he ever was, and he's a little more contested. For 200 years, conservatives did everything they could to crap all over his memory. And then Reagan came along and laid claim to him. So in Reagan's acceptance speech for the presidential nomination in 1980 at the Republican convention, he shook up the Republicans by quoting in order, basically Thomas Paine, Abraham Lincoln, and Franklin Roosevelt, three obviously progressive figures in the American story. And even George Will, who is still today probably the leading conservative columnist in America, he was outraged that Ronald Reagan quoted Thomas Paine and not Edmund Burke in his acceptance speech. But it is the case that we have every reason to lay claim to the revolution. We have every reason, especially, to lay claim to our champion, Thomas Paine. And I can also tell you that Abraham Lincoln read Paine as a young man, and his very, very much influenced, not only in his literary and speech writing style, but also in his very thinking about American democratic life. And similarly, Franklin Roosevelt at critical moments in the 1940s would quote Thomas Paine, as did Eleanor Roosevelt regularly. So there were those who tried to sustain his memory.
I was going to add there real quick with Lincoln. A lot of people don't realize this, but Lincoln also had some friendly correspondence with Karl Marx.
Yeah, I believe, let's put it this way. I'm not exactly sure he had the direct correspondence. That I'm not yet persuaded. But I have little doubt that by way of third parties, that there was this kind of interaction and influence. Marx wrote for the Herald Tribune out of New York, and it was not unusual for Marx's readers to pick up his ideas. And many of those folks who did pick up his ideas were, in fact, very, very close to Lincoln, and in certain cases, his political advisors. The best way to look at that is to pick up John Nichols' book titled The S Word, Socialism. He does a really good job of linking the Paineite and Marxian movements of the mid-19th century to Lincoln, although John always said that I helped turn him on to the Paineite connection. But there is this recognition that Lincoln is very much influenced both by Thomas Paine and quite possibly, given the socialists of the mid-19th century, many of whom were utopian socialists, they probably got to Lincoln as well. The other thing I was going to say about it is that Lincoln is, if you look closely at his writings, he's not exactly a socialist at any point, but Lincoln, both politically and intellectually, believed that labor comes before capital, okay? That those who would make this claim that capitalists are the makers and the rest of us are takers, bullshit. Lincoln is pretty clear that labor creates capital, number one. Number two, it's pretty clear that he is very, very hostile to the kinds of inequalities that will emerge after the Civil War, in which capital is you know, dominant both in political power and wealth. So, you know, I mean, more power to Lincoln and more power to us. And by the way, in that respect, I'll tell you, I think it was about 1931, FDR wrote to a friend, a historian, and who was a prominent figure in the Democratic Party, and he said, you know, the Republicans have turned their back on Lincoln. I think it's time we made him one of our own, meaning it's time for liberals and the left to lay claim to Lincoln. And I think it's even easier to do that now than ever.
Well, I want to move into FDR a little bit, which you've done a lot of work on, the history of the FDR administration, the Four Freedoms, etc. But maybe summing it up, what is it that radicals can take away from the legacies of figures like Paine and Lincoln? If you could wrap that up in a little maybe.
Well, first of all, Paine is the original inspiration for American radicalism and American democratic life. And it isn't that we only have to draw a lesson from the past. It's that when we think about who we are, and when we come to realize why it is we're so anxious about the state of American democratic life, it's because we are endowed, we are imbued with a radical spirit that Thomas Paine afforded us, most especially in common sense, first of all. But Franklin Roosevelt, here's the thing about Franklin Roosevelt. Roosevelt had tremendous confidence in his fellow citizens. The New Deal experience is not only the programs initiated by Roosevelt and the Democrats, the progressives of the day, it's also the fact that he empowered American working people. He signed on, not only in the National Labor Relations Act later in 1935, but as originally in the National Industrial Recovery Act of 1933, these empowered working people to organize unions. In fact, FDR is very interesting. He really showed his confidence. He gave a speech, I think it was in 1935, especially had to do with, the emergence of a kind of housewives movement demanding some controls being imposed over business. And even after the legislation was enacted, Roosevelt said, "New laws in themselves do not bring the new millennium." But his point was is the struggle begins now as much as it existed in the past. Laws themselves are not going to guarantee that the corporate powers that be are going to obey those laws. They're going to try not only in the courts, but even in the workplace to smash labor. I mean, he fully appreciated the imperative of engaging and empowering working people. And by doing so, he ends up going further politically than he might otherwise have done in the New Deal. So the lesson of the Roosevelt years, there are several. One of them, I've been spouting this line ever since 2016 when Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders were competing for the nomination. And you heard Hillary Clinton over and over again say, "I want to be your champion." Well, bullshit. I don't want a champion. I don't want someone to fight for me. I want someone who will encourage the fight in us, in me. And which is one of the reasons I have real hope that Bernie Sanders will possibly get the nomination. I mean, Franklin Roosevelt inspired American working people in all the diversity to fight. He didn't ask them to wait on whatever he could accomplish. He inspired them and encouraged them to fight. And I think one of the mistakes that the left for too long has made is to turn their back on Roosevelt's example and to draw strength, not only that we can do great social democratic things, but also that the way in which we do them is to have confidence in our fellow citizens and basically to encourage them to remember who they are and in those terms, you know, encourage the fight in them.
Well, maybe we could talk a little bit about the four freedoms. For people that are unfamiliar with the four freedoms, maybe we could go over them real quickly. Freedom of speech, freedom of worship, freedom from want, and freedom from fear. I mentioned the freedom from fear one recently during a conversation at the bar, and someone said to me, I don't like that one. And I said, well, why not? You know, we should have a freedom. You know, I shouldn't have to worry when I go outside that I'm going to be attacked. And then they said, I never thought of it that way.
Well, he likes freedom from fear. No, right. I mean, he wants to be free from fear.
Right. Well, this person, I don't think they were looking at it that way. I think there's this, the person I was talking to, I think they have that libertarian sort of idea of freedom. They don't differentiate between positive and negative liberty.
Well, okay. I mean, here's the thing. It's funny that, because I often hear people say, oh, that freedom from want, isn't that demanding too much? Look, these are ideals. Ideals drive us in a progressive direction. Look, freedom of speech, freedom of worship, freedom of religion, they're embedded in the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. But even to this day, we know that they're not fully realized as liberties, as freedoms. I mean, freedom of speech is itself always under siege by the fact that we have monopoly corporations that dominate the American airwaves, the American public discourse. I mean, even in this age where we can have, you know, 1,000 podcasters promoting progressive ideas, it's still the case that when people go turn on the television or turn on the radio, all they're over and over again going to get right-wing talk, or they're going to get maybe some watered-down version of liberal left conversation on MSNBC, which is an utter embarrassment as a formerly liberal standard bearer. So, you know, I mean, it's the case that freedom of speech is we've not accomplished that. Yeah, you can go on the street corner possibly and talk to people. You can go into your bar and talk to friends about the four freedoms. But it's still the case that when's the last time you actually heard the four freedoms talked about in a public debate on television, right? I mean, when? When have we talked about the degree to which we might want to literally endow some kind of trusts that would underwrite newspapers? Our loss of local newspapers is devastating to American democratic life. Okay. Freedom of worship doesn't mean only that you have the right to think and pray. You can think. You don't ever have to worry about what you want to think. You can think what you want. The fact is, are you going to feel comfortable in your beliefs? I mean, so back in the 1930s, when Jews in Boston might go to and fro from the synagogue, they'd have to worry that some Irish Boston thug was going to beat the shit out of them because they weren't Catholic or, you know, something like that, which happened regularly in the 1930s. Or how about in many places in 1930s, Catholics in Indiana had to worry they might be attacked by the likes of Klansmen in the 1920s and 30s, that is. I mean, the idea of freedom of worship is not only the ability to pray as you wish to pray, it's also that you can be an American and not have to bow to any particular church, or you can literally ignore church altogether. So even those things remain in their own fashion, to some extent, tenuous. But then if we move on, freedom from want and freedom from fear, those are fundamentally American values that go all the way back to the time of the Revolution, in spite of the fact that, and all we have to remember is that the Declaration, which as FDR once said, is our original social contract, said life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And if you're going to have life, you need certain essentials, you know, food, clothing, and shelter. And when we ask our students, well, if the Declaration is a declaration for all time, what do you need today to make it in the world? And they tell us education. They tell us you have to have access to ideas. You have to have the ability to learn. So food, clothing, and shelter are just beginning to get at the idea of what we need to have life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And the American promise is there. That's the promise of America: life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So freedom from want is a further expression, you might say, Roosevelt's way of expressing that original life and liberty and pursuit of happiness. And freedom from fear, well, when he spoke of these in January of 41, he had mostly in mind that we need to create a world guided by these four fundamental values and ideas.
The but Universal Declaration of Human Rights, right?
Which comes about after World War II. And Eleanor Roosevelt played maybe the most prominent role in composing them. And FDR himself had died in 1945. But the four freedoms are rooted in the Declaration, the Preamble, and Bill of Rights. We hear it in many ways in Abraham Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. Government of the people, by the people, for the people. And then Roosevelt is harnessing those fundamentals. He's taking hold of history in order to make America radical again. Radical in the sense of freedom of speech and expression, freedom of worship or religion, freedom from want, and freedom from fear. Those are powerful ideals, and they led a whole generation to recast American life.
Yeah, those last two especially hit well for me. I think when you mention them without context, some people get confused. Like I said, I had to sort of explain the freedom from want, the freedom from fear, to people that were unfamiliar with it, but I think they stick. You know, freedom from fear especially was about, I believe, the reduction of armaments
when he gave the speech in the State of the Union Address of January 1941, he was projecting a world beyond the war. But when Americans heard it, they translated it into very specific American terms. That is, freedom from want meant we're going to revive the New Deal of the 1930s, and we're going to extend Social Security to include national health care. Critical question, okay? FDR wanted national health care in Social Security. But the AMA, the American Medical Association, and the corporate powers that be said they would declare war on the making of Social Security if that was the case. So he held off believing that would come later. Okay? And, you know, we've seen real progress back in the 60s with Medicare and Medicaid. We've seen progress with Obamacare, but it remains the case that the richest, most powerful nation on earth, the United States of America, has yet to create universal health care, or as we now hear, the need for Medicare for all.
Well, I was going to say just the last thing in terms of the last of those two four freedoms and pushback I've gotten from them. When people say they're uncomfortable with the freedom from want freedom from fear, I'm amazed because I think it shows that the idea of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness for many in this country, due to the right-wing propaganda machine, in my opinion,
yes,
they've sort of turned it into life, liberty, and the pursuit of property above all else. And that's
right,
why it's hard
yeah.
for people to accept all of these, which is unfortunate in my view.
Yeah, well, of course, the original ideal, the Lockean ideal, was life, liberty, and property, the security of those things. And in their own curious way, that founding generation used the term pursuit of happiness, which, by the way, I often think is further proof that they had a vision for the ages and not simply for the late 18th century. For all of their sins, which we could go on and on about, slavery, marginalization of women, and so on, it is the case that they offered, I mean, of all people, Thomas Jefferson, the slaveholder himself, authors it, but they offered a vision that would inspire as a promise, you know, generations. Every American recognizes the lines, you know, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, you know, the right to those things. Every American recognizes it. In fact, they recognize it so well that they probably, you know, most of the time take it for granted, not realizing that, you know, the time, look, we're in a crisis. Let's get to the heart of the matter. We're in a crisis right now. We have inequality on an unprecedented scale. We have concentrations of power and wealth which are utterly destroying American democratic life. We have not just a president and a party that are eager to subvert, if not destroy, the nation as we know it, but we have corporate powers that be that enabled that to happen, and we have a Democratic Party which for four decades has failed to call out Americans to defend the American promise. This is a critical moment, which is why I'm saying that the time has come to take hold of our history and make America radical again. Radical in the sense of harnessing the powers of democratic government to extend and deepen freedom, equality, and democracy.
I want to get into that just a little bit more, but I wanted to ask you as well, in terms of FDR, how much pushback did he face from Wall Street and corporate power at the time? I know a lot of people will try to bring up the business plot, which that is more of a gray area than people admit. Like, I think the historical consensus is that it's not as sensational as what people think.
Well, there's no doubt that the richest men in America wanted to destroy the Roosevelt administration. In 1934-35, they created the American Liberty League and spent millions of dollars by way of radio and film and other, you know, media of the day to literally accuse Roosevelt of either being a fascist, a communist, or somebody wanted to regiment America into an un-American kind of social order. And fortunately, they utterly failed to generate any kind of grassroots support. And Roosevelt, knowing that these folks controlled the media, I mean, newspaper publishers were not friends of Franklin Roosevelt. Newspaper journalists were friends of Roosevelt, not newspaper editors and publishers. So what Roosevelt learned how to do, which was a technological innovation, which is why podcasting is such a fascinating thing today, is Roosevelt went on radio. The famous fireside chats, where he would talk to Americans about the issues of the day, and he would explain to Americans the need to enhance the New Deal, to create new initiatives, to provide jobs, to prevent poverty from intensifying, to empower workers, to regulate banks and businesses. He learned the art of communication, and he was a phenomenal performer on the radio. So he went around, if you like, the control of the media that the corporations had, and went on radio. Now look, everyone knows that Clear Channel utterly destroyed talk radio by making it 24-hour right-wing talk radio. So what did the left do? Well, at first they didn't know what to do, but people moved into the internet. Okay, nowadays we have podcasters such as yourself. We have online radio and television programming. The largest online news service, is, at least as they project themselves, is the Young Turks Network. And I'll be visiting them next week out in California. I mean, we do have the makings of a left media, which doesn't speak at all with a singular voice, thank goodness. But we have this kind of technological change that's underway. But that doesn't excuse the corporate power that controls the main television and cable networks.
You know, it's interesting because one of the things I get when I speak fondly of, say, FDR's New Deal or even LBJ's Great Society is, some centrist Democrats will say to me, so you want to go back to the days of, you know, racism and Southern Democrats. How do you respond to that?
Tell them, first of all, you're not being nostalgic. God damn it. You're not being nostalgic. You're not saying, let's go back. What you're saying is, if those folks in the 1930s could accomplish all of that, despite the social divisions, despite the cultural divisions, despite the religious divisions, if they could unify and create a massive labor movement, if working women from Brooklyn and Harlem to North and South Dakota to the West Coast could create a housewives movement that would shake up America, if all of that was possible, then what we can do is even more remarkable. Because we at least get to stand on the shoulders of those struggles and the achievements of a generation. I mean, from 1935 until 1975, Americans got richer, and yet at the very same time, inequality decreased. The story of America is a lesson in struggle. It's a story that actually we can achieve. It's when we forget who we are that we fail to achieve. So tell your friends to shut up, okay, and start thinking. You're not asking to go back in time. You're asking to go forward. Okay, you're asking them to remember who they are and not to run scared and hide behind weak excuses.
Well, it's as we begin to wrap up, I think it's often for me a very scary time and a very exciting time. When I hear, you know, I've had some Democrats say things like after 2016 when Trump won, I noticed a lot of people were saying, well, it seems like democracy has failed, or, you know, people losing faith in the democratic process. I don't think we should feel that way. I think democracy is the way to go. How do
democracy
you think we combat the pessimism?
Yeah, democracy is revolutionary. Look, we've been suffering, enduring 45 years of class war from above, which is why we've got the inequality we have, the concentrations of power and wealth, the smashing of labor unions, the efforts to take away the rights of women to control their own bodies, the denial of voting rights that was guaranteed in the Voting Rights Act. I mean, over and over again, we've seen class war and culture war destroy the legacy of the greatest generation of the 30s through the 70s.
Would you say, real quick, would you say that those elements have sort of maybe made their way into the Democratic Party in some ways? I almost feel that.
I'll go further than that. I hold the Democratic Party accountable for the last 40 and 45 years. Look, Jimmy Carter, Bill Clinton, and Barack Obama failed the American people. Okay? Jimmy Carter was ultimately a conservative. Turned his back on labor, he turned his back on the consumer rights movement, deregulated large portions of American capital, and basically paved the way for Ronald Reagan. Bill Clinton, what's his first major legislative initiative? NAFTA, North American Free Trade Agreement, which was to turn his back on the labor and environmental movements that helped put him into office. If you look closely at the Clinton administration years, they were absolutely abysmal for American working people, and they paved the way for the devastation of the 2007, 8, 9 crashes and recession. I mean, one of the reasons, look, why did Americans in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, you're in Pennsylvania, I'm in Wisconsin, why did they elect Donald Trump? Because the majority of Americans voted for Hillary Clinton, because they were so pissed off with the establishment, capital E, including the Democratic establishment, otherwise known as the Clinton machine, that they were just wanted to punch in the nose those establishments. Okay? And as a consequence, they got, tragically, Donald Trump. There was a poll done during the 2015-16 cycle, and the poll showed that the majority of Americans wanted radical action to address America's problems. The two candidates who should have been running against each other were Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders. Sanders would have won. He would have taken Pennsylvania and Michigan and Wisconsin, unquestioning. He would have won. But what did we have? We put up Hillary Clinton, who was the more popular candidate, but couldn't win in the states devastated by 45 years of class war, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin. So, you know, I mean, the story isn't the failure of democracy at this point. It's the failure of the Democratic Party to remain the party of working people. That's the story. And I'm pretty clear about it. I unreservedly make that argument. And it was the argument in many ways of the latter part of my Thomas Paine book, Thomas Paine and the Promise of America. And it was definitely the argument I make in the last third of my book on Franklin Roosevelt, the greatest generation, and the four freedoms, the fight for the four freedoms. And the more I've looked into that, and over and over again, I come back to the same conclusion, that just look at who the Democratic leadership was and what they did to a party that was once the party of working people.
I would agree 110%. I find it so strange when people use a term like, even when people use the term populism, as like just a blanket bad word, a naughty word to describe. You know, oh, all populists are evil right wingers. And I'm like, I don't think that's the case. I have faith in, you know, the masses of our country. I don't think they're stupid. And I don't think we always need technocrats to decide everything. I think the people are smart enough. We the people.
Yeah, good democratic politics, small d or capital D, requires good citizens and smart leaders And what we have lacked over and over again are smart leaders, people who can engage the imaginations of American working people. I mean, the likes of a Franklin Roosevelt, to be honest, in literary terms, somebody like Thomas Paine, who saw what the promise and the prospects of the American life were. Now, today, I think it's odd, for example, but it's wonderful to think about that a man in his late 70s named Bernie Sanders, a Jewish socialist originally from Brooklyn, who moved to Vermont, a state which had historically been Republican, and basically becomes the U.S. senator from that state, becomes the standard bearer for the best of American progressive politics. And who does he appeal to? To young people. The majority of young Americans to this day, since 2015, want Bernie Sanders to be the leader of the Democratic Party and to become president of the United States. I mean, it's an astounding thing. And he's pulled the Democratic Party in many ways back towards the Roosevelt tradition. But they're resisting. Joe Biden, is Pete Buttigieg, Amy Klobuchar, these folks are resisting the American working people that they're supposed to be representing.
And there were just a few more things real quickly I wanted to touch on. The first was there was a segment of the book that really fascinated me where you begin by talking about...
We're talking about the Take Hold of Our History book.
Yes, yes.
Yes, okay.
You were talking about how you had a student who... I guess after one of their tests, they said, I'm switching over to business because true as everything you're saying is, it just seems like we're up against insurmountable odds, you know, the oligarchy.
Right.
How would you respond to that sort of pessimism that a lot of young people have?
Well, I don't think they have that pessimism. So let's put it this way. I think the pessimism was stronger then about 1992 into 3, 4, 5, right in that stretch. Stronger then than it is now. I mean, I think even in the course of 2015-16, you could feel a resurgent democratic impulse. I mean, going into 2015-16, there was the fight for 15. There had been the Wisconsin Rising. There had been the Occupy movement. There was the Moral Monday movement in North Carolina. I mean, the immigrant rights movement. I mean, there was real energy in American public life of a progressive sort. And the Democratic Party failed to harness that energy. And as you know, they elected Hillary Clinton and said she wanted to be our champion instead of encourage the fight in us. Now, so let's be clear about that. But that student of mine really taught me a lesson. So the department that I'm in really did emphasize questions of power and questions of change and how American history and world history were made. But we were perhaps giving too much emphasis in the wake of the Reagan administration years and the Bush administration years. Our imaginations, our attentions were probably given more to power than to progress, or if you like, more to how the powers that be shape American imagination rather than the degree to which Americans themselves actually had created a better, more progressive America through the generations. So when she finished the test, which was a test, I believe, in my course, Power and Change, and she had been reading books like Ralph Miliband's State and Capitalist Society, things like that, she said in that test that you quoted from, you know, I agree with everything that we've been reading, all these arguments about the power of big business. And as a consequence, I'm going to go transfer into the business program because we can't beat them. Might as well join them. So I said to my colleagues, and I actually shifted the emphasis of my teaching, which was natural because that was the story of my research. I shifted my emphasis to focus more and more on how history is made, not only by the powers that be from above, but no less by the struggles from below. And, you know, she made a difference in my life. I have no idea where she went following her business degree that she got, but you know, maybe she found out that she didn't care for business after all and probably joined a labor union in some workplace. I don't know.
It's very easy to get into that sort of pessimistic funk, I think. You mentioned, at one point that even C. Wright Mills, the great sociologist who wrote about the power elite, I mean, he once referred to everyone as cheerful robots, or just cheerful robots to the system.
Right, yeah. You know, I was and I remain a remarkably huge. My generation in social science really sort of idolized C. Wright Mills, the book The Power Elite,
I mean, I just want to say, he was kind of a badass. He was a motorcyclist and all this other stuff. He was cool.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Back in, I think it was late in the war, he didn't serve in the military. He was 4F. But late in the war, he actually decided he was going to try to use all of his intellectual capacity to challenge the powers that be for the rest of his career. And he set out to do that. And the Power Elite was a classic of power analysis and the degree to which the business elite, the military elite, and the political or governmental elite was like a circulation of elites. As would that have been, who talks circulation of elites? Was that not Pareto? It was either Mosca or Michels, the Italian theorist. And in many ways, he was showing the degree to which Americans were losing control of their own lives, losing control of American democracy. And when he wrote another book, The Sociological Imagination, that was published in 1959, this would be the 60th anniversary of the publication of that book. God, I love that book. I used it in all my social science teaching. He refers, as you said, to his fellow citizens as cheerful robots. And I think he meant it as a shock thing, that he would shock Americans into saying, no, but he did do that. A cheerful robots is the image of automatons, you know, programmed, happy slave kind of situation. And I thought, whoa, you got to think about this, you know, that this person who we've been idolizing may himself have been sort of incapable of guiding us to a more effective small d democratic social science. He didn't fully lose control of his democratic sensibilities, but sometimes his language got in the way, I think.
Well, I mentioned Mills too, because I think at the heart of Take Hold of Our History is the reason we need to take hold of our history is to recapture the social imagination. Because once we have that social imagination, we can begin to create a better world.
Yeah. The social imagination, or as he called it, sociological imagination, isn't that we're supposed to fantasize. Okay. People think of imagination as somehow we go get high and fantasize, or we go off into the desert and live like monks and sort of, you know, try to fantasize an alternative universe. No, what Mills was getting at is the idea that history and politics and our own lives offer possibilities. And what we need to do is not allow ourselves to be wrapped up in the minutia, that we needed to, in many ways, to think about the grand picture of things and how it was that we look into the past and consider the ways in which in the past we've used reason in pursuit of freedom. And that freedom that we can secure enables us to exercise our reason all the more. So those were his two key words, reason and freedom, and ultimately the pursuit of an enhanced American democratic life.
And final thing before we go, you know, I'm a big history buff, so I like a lot of the references you make in the book. I just wanted to mention, at the end of the book, you mention a character by the name of Sinclair Lewis and a very important book he wrote called It Can't Happen Here. And at the beginning, you mentioned Max Lerner.
Yeah, that was one of the essays, one of the essays in Take Hold of Our History, where everyone, you know, that basically we were facing with the Donald Trump political victory, the real threat of, if not fascism, of some kind of authoritarianism, domination by the power elite in a really harsh billionaire style. And Sinclair Lewis had written in 1935 a warning. He said it can't happen here. He probably would have preferred calling it can happen here, but his publishers, I think, changed the title. And what he meant by that is that there was that possibility that we would allow right-wing populists to gain control of American democratic life and lead us in a fascist direction. You know, it's never out of the question. We have to be vigilant. And to be vigilant means not only to watch out for threats, but also to be vigilant requires us to enhance American democratic life. But I cut you off. What were you going to ask?
Well, I was going to say, I think you answered my question with regards to Sinclair Lewis. I just wanted to get a mention in of him because I think that book is very important. When I first started college, people used to say to me, it can't happen here. We could never get fascism here. And I'm like, well, you should read that Sinclair Lewis book. And they would sort of look at me and be like, you read too many books. But he made a very good point.
If you like that book, you should read Philip Roth's The Plot Against America.
That's another excellent one. We always have to remain vigilant, though. And I want to add, too, I think we should use populist in quotes when it comes to right-wing populists. I feel like these are ultimately strongmen. They're not for the people necessarily.
Right. Well, here's the thing that I've been concerned about for years. People say the radical right and the radical left. Well, when I was growing up, we had better terms. We talked about radicals as being folks on the left who wanted to fight to enhance American democratic life. And on the right
were the reactionaries.
Right, reactionaries. You've got it. Exactly. You bet. We've lost that word. So, I'd like to hear more people on those few occasions that I do turn on cable news. I'd like to hear them use the term reactionary. I think that'd be great. Let Americans realize what we're up against.
And I guess the other thing I was going to mention was, and this is a good way to end the show, because I always like to end on a positive note, and I think good. This is how we can do it. You begin the book by quoting a forgotten figure who you reminded me of, Max Lerner. And maybe you could talk a little bit about Max Lerner and how he influenced your work and why you quoted him at the beginning.
Well, I can't be sure as to when I first ran into his work, but I know this. When I was working on The Fight for the Four Freedoms, the book about Roosevelt and the Greatest Generation, I threw myself really deeply into the columnists of the day so I could get a feel for what journalists and newspaper editors were saying. And I came across Lerner's writings, first collections of his columns, and I was really impressed by the degree to which he was constantly talking past and present, Lincoln and Roosevelt. And I didn't have space to quote it in the opening of the book, but he lays out in one page the story of American progressivism and radicalism. I thought, wow, this guy has a real sense of the ways in which American history has been made from the bottom up. That was the first thing. And then I read his book, It Is Later Than You Think, The Need for a Militant Democracy. And I loved the title. And in this book, he reveals himself to be, it's going to sound strange, a capital M, capital D, Marxist Democrat. Okay? Which is to say that he had little doubt about the degree to which there was a class struggle between capital and working people. But it was also the case that he came to appreciate the degree to which American democratic life was itself a pursuit to tame and in many ways and possibly create social democracy and democratic socialism. And I really just found his writing remarkable. And I used to think, oh, if I could just write something like that. So I'll tell people, if they do pick up the take hold of our history, Make America Radical Again, it's called the epigraph, they call it. And in the epigraph, if you don't mind, I'd just like to quote a couple of things from that.
No problem.
The basic story in the American past, the only story ultimately worth the telling, is the story of the struggle between the creative and the frustrating elements in the democratic adventure. I love that. I thought all my course syllabi, I put that on. And then there's a line I just love to tweet. Every generation needs to know what it is fighting against, whom it is fighting with, what it is fighting for. And that's the kind of writing I really do love that. So yeah, I embraced Max Lerner of the 1930s and 1940s. And by the way, I just mentioned Twitter. If anybody is interested, I'm on Twitter very actively. And my Twitter handle is @Harvey, @KAYE. So if you're interested, you can give me a follow. I try to respond to everyone, at least welcome them aboard. And if you read the book, I'm happy to hear what you think and we can talk about it.
Well, in closing, I want to thank you for coming on Parallax Views. And I just want to get your thought real quick. Do you think that we will be successful in taking hold of our history? And then maybe you can tell listeners how they can get a hold of the new book.
Okay, so I don't predict the future. I can only hope for the future. And I seriously do hope. And I get a lot of warmth and confidence from the fact that young people are responding to the two more progressive figures in the Democratic Party, both Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, and especially to Bernie Sanders. That gives me hope, number one. And when I see the likes of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and to see them together, both Bernie and AOC, I just think that's fabulous. The book itself is obviously readily available on Amazon. If anybody finds it immoral to shop on Amazon, it's available also at Barnes & Noble. You can go into independent bookstores or go online to various independent bookstores and ask for it that way, though I've been looking myself to see if there are alternatives for people, and some of them are either back-ordered or whatever. So the book is in paperback. It's at a price that remarkably low price of about $14. And if it's got no footnotes, okay, no footnotes. It's written as a series of speeches and essays. It's written because it was written in many ways as speeches for labor groups, for student audiences. One of them is a speech for the League of Women Voters, which has moved steadily to the left these past 5 years. And I'd love to hear what you think about it.
Well, I'm just going to add real quick. What I got out of this book is that, you know, people today will talk about the white working class and this and that. And I'm like, it isn't about the white working class. It's about the working class. It's about, you know, it doesn't matter if you're black, white, woman, man. We're all part of this.
Right. Absolutely. And there's a thing I tell people. We have to understand that the story of the struggles of African Americans, of women, of immigrant generations, that's our story. It's not their story, it's our story. So we need to create this narrative in which we identify ourselves with the American experience all the more deeply. And that's the way we draw inspiration to make America radical again.
And Bernie Sanders actually is starting to do that now. He didn't do it as much in 2016,
but
now I see him doing it more.
Very little. I voted for Bernie, but I was over and over again critical of his failure to do that. This time around, I'd like to think he read my books. I know that he had them available to him. I mean, people gave them to him. I gave him a couple of copies myself. And all of a sudden, he began to speak of FDR in a really regular way. And he's calling for an economic bill of rights based on FDR's call for an economic bill of rights. He's calling for a Green New Deal, which is standing on the shoulders of Roosevelt's own New Deal. He's pushing workplace democracy, which was a part of the Democratic agenda in the 1930s by way of industrial democracy. So, you know, history doesn't repeat itself, but it sure as hell gives us an opportunity to try and make it better.
Well, thank you again, Harvey Kaye, for coming on Parallax Views. Everyone check out Take Hold of Our History, Make America Radical Again.
Thanks.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Professor Harvey J. Kaye, author of the new Zero Books title, Take Hold of Our History, Make America Radical Again. And I also hope you had a very happy, safe, and good Thanksgiving. Let me know what you thought of this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at @viewsparallax or by email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. Also, a reminder, you can support me on Patreon, where you can hear the exclusive bonus shows, The Week That Was, a current events program hosted by me and my pal Casey, and the Parallax Views After Hours program, which features interviews not available on the main feed, including a conversation with Hugo Turner of Anti-Imperialist U on the situation in Bolivia. All that and more available to Patreon supporters of Parallax Views. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say, don't do it. got to prohibit. If nothing else, if we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight. With no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.